Welcome to A Mathematical Basis for Reality.
Chris, I think you should tell them that Physical Truth is a book on mathematics and philosophy, and that it's a good story.
I think I lost everybody with the Einstein field equations. Guess it was a little dry. Just discovered a new book about to arrive. I ordered it in from Dr. Sabine Hossenfelder from Germany. It's interesting. I think she worked with the Perimeter Institute, and back in Germany, I think she began her own Institute for Theoretical Physics. So this is quite a smart lady, and she was talking about physics. In particular, science in general, as following down sort of a path of popularity. That once you get everybody believing stuff, then everybody starts to believe it. And I think it's significant that she's a German scientist, and as a German scientist, showing the devastation of the last century from fascism, and this sort of way of thinking, and to compare that with what's happening in modern science, I think it's significant. I think it's a very, very scary thing that she's bringing up, and I think it's quite important. So I really, really look forward to reading her book.
So I saw an interesting video up an ad about a book about math, and as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh my gosh, this sounds just like you. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to get you to meet this woman, or at least read her book and then meet this woman. And now you're telling me that you've already ordered it and that it should be here soon. And I can't wait for you to read it, because it sounds like she is on the same wavelength as you, and it's very exciting.
Yeah, thank you. It's like I think physics is in a severe crisis, and in a way has been hijacked. And any new approach to some of the problems we have in physics, we're just totally held off from being taken a look at it. And all I'm doing is basically going back to the basic math. She says that talking about beauty in math, that beauty is a prerequisite, or what is elegant. If anybody's tried messing with Maxwell's equations, you can get yourself tied up in a complete knot. And let's face it, there are some wild things going in Schrodinger's equation. Sure, it's one equation, but you can go all sorts of places with it. The Einstein field equations, I just spent about half an hour or so just trying to go through what they were. Yeah, I think lost everybody doing it. So it depends what you mean by elegant. It can actually solve it, but it may not look particularly beautiful. It depends what you mean by beauty.
I noticed that she talks about that in her video. So who are we talking about? What is her name again?
Oh, Dr. Sabine Hossenfelder.
And her name is called, and her book is called Lost in Math.
Yes, Lost in Math.
And I have heard you say the same things, and I don't know whether you were quoting her when she was talking about how math, that everybody is stuck on math being beautiful and math being, you know, unified. Or maybe unified is not the word she used. Anyways, that math has to be, you know, that everybody's on this idea of math being beautiful. And she's saying, but what about the ugly parts, and that we're missing, you know, that's, and I've heard you talk about math having to be beautiful, and it's not necessarily has to be beautiful, it has to work. But were you quoting her, or are you?
No, that's been my own idea.
Yeah,
like for
I've heard
years
you say that
years.
Many times. So when I saw this trailer and that she was using almost your exact words, and I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, because what has happened is I think people have confused beauty with simplicity. For example, we take Schrodinger's equation, all right, which is basically just the diffusion equation with a linear term added onto it. Now, you start attacking Schrodinger's equation with spherical coordinates and solving it with spherical coordinates, you're going to have some real fun. There's a considerable amount of work to do. It's not exactly what I would call pretty, but it does actually work. And you have to do a lot of reduction by the time you get to the end of it to get what's called the eigenvalues, which I'm I'm basically showing, and to be able to get Heisenberg out of it. There's a confusion, I really think, because people now talk about the time-independent Schrödinger equation, and I'm looking at it and say, that's nonsense. If it's time-independent, you can't have an event. There's no such thing as a time-independent happening of an event. Without an event, you don't have Schrödinger's equation. And it's just the properties of the diffusion equation that you get things like spooky action at a distance and so forth. It's all, you know, neatly explained. I think Schrödinger's equation is extremely elegant and very, very beautiful in my way of doing it. But I can fill a whiteboard messing with it. I can fill a few whiteboards messing with it to show its actual, like, how do you solve it and so forth. I think it's just a bunch of people that don't know how to solve differential equations that have simplified it so much and then made such silly conclusions from the thing that we've gone completely completely off the what I would say is the path towards finding out what's going on, or to have a better understanding of how the universe is actually working and our relationship between ourselves and the universe. And that's just Schrödinger's equation. Once you get into the Einstein field equations, you've got to take Maxwell's equations, then add them in to the Einstein field equations, which Einstein did in 1915. But I haven't seen anybody that's actually included that. That is not easy stuff. It may look fairly simple, but it most certainly is not. It's you really have to have a solid understanding of tensors and tensor calculus, and, you know, some understanding of the consequences of what you're doing, and you should be able to develop the Einstein field equations from first principles, which is not that hard to do, but it's a heck of a lot of work. If you're doing a four-dimensional, you've got a four-dimensional Minkowski space, basically it's an L2 measure in a four-dimensional Minkowski space, and you start applying that with curved space, depending on the curvature of the space, it can become huge, right? It is not pretty. There's a lot of work to be done, and you got to hack through it and trace it through, not make any mistakes. So it depends what you mean by beautiful. I think people are really confusing beauty with simplicity, and they're simplifying like crazy because they're incompetent at doing the math.
That's a big statement.
Yeah.
So the thing is that we're losing people left, right, and center, because you're getting so mathematical. And I think, because I'm not a mathematical person, but I can follow sometimes the larger picture of what you're saying without understanding all the mathematics. And that's what keeps me intrigued. So can you tell us sort of where you're going with all of this, or give people something that they can, you know, that'll keep them? Because as you've said, getting into the field equations, getting into, you know, all these other things can get pretty deep and maybe losing a few people along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to lose people so that they don't get to the end, which is going to pull all of this together and give us some brilliant insights into the workings of the universe. So can you help us along a little bit here, where we're going?
Okay, I'm trying to take it down step by step. I can say the mathematics is beautiful, but it's not pretty, if that helps. Okay, it's elegant, it is beautiful, it's breathtaking, but it ain't pretty. Okay? Reminds me of a 60s song or a 70s song. She ain't pretty. Anyway, so looking at where we're going eventually is in what is our relationship to the universe around us. We have a relationship within consciousness of who we are. We understand that we are conscious and aware of our own existence. We do actually exist. There is a world outside of us while during this life we experience. That world also exists. So we have a relationship between ourselves and the world around us. I am taking a look at very, very, very simple things, such as what is the world of a photon? What is the world of a photon interacting with a gravitational field, which is the world around this particular photon? And then we can apply how, you know, outwardly from that. So we take a look also at the most important thing. So it's very, very simple stuff. If we now go into what's really important, it's really the relationship between individuals and the relationship between people. So what I have to do is take this and build it up step by step so it's irrefutable from basic principles that truth actually exists. We can find something that is true and then move for what is true and how does that apply to the relationships we have with each other.
Okay, so what is the next thing that's coming up in physical truth?
Okay, the next thing that's coming up is a photon interaction with the sun, gravitational field. Now, when I saw this, I realized that it wasn't just actual a path. It's a very subtle thing. It wasn't just the photon, the gravitational field within the curvature of space-time, which is what we do. But there are consequences to it in energy considerations to change momentum. When the photon changes direction because of the existence of a gravitational field, so it goes in a different direction because of the presence of a gravitational field than what it would without the gravitational field being present. Because of this, there is a change in momentum of the photon. It's changed direction. To change direction, there's a change in momentum. And if there's a change in momentum, that requires energy, requires a force over distance, requires energy. And that energy has to come from somewhere. It comes to the photon. The photon becomes extremely, extremely redshifted. I had this idea. It was at Cam's place. I think it was 2007. I was going through it, trying to get it. And I texted Teddy Schmidt about this thing. I said, the photon has to be redshifted. When it goes through a gravitational field, it has to be redshifted. I know it. And Teddy wrote back this rather brilliant question in an email. He says, well, Bruce, if it redshifts, where does the energy go? You know, you got to balance the energy. And it took me a long time to figure it out. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. It took me a couple of hours while I'm chewing on this. And I realized the photon moves the sun. A single photon changing direction, it actually pulls the sun. Unbelievably small. And I can calculate it by simply using a collision, by simply treating it as a billiard ball bouncing off another billiard ball. Now, one billiard ball is incredibly light, and the other billiard ball is incredibly big and heavy, but doesn't matter. And it works out that you actually use a different process than just sometimes as assuming that the photon has mass and things like that. That's not what I'm doing. What I'm doing is I can go to quantum mechanics, which is what Einstein based E equals H nu, and also Planck gave us with H nu, and then I can, and using these equations for the momentum of the photon, be able to find out how much the photon is redshifted, which is an extremely small amount. It's not enough to explain what we call the redshift or the galactic redshift, but it is an extremely small amount and is measurable. And also, what I'm not talking about also is that the light also becomes slightly polarized. This would become quite valuable because what I want to do is start doing readings on the background radiation. And look at the background radiation with polarization around the what's called anomalies. So the background radiation is not nice and smooth. It's got these holes in it. It's got these deviations in it called anomalies. And these anomalies all are a deviation of 1/1000th of a degree. This is at 2.7 degrees absolute, so very, very cold. And there's a deviation in the background radiation of all these little holes that are almost all 1/1000th of a degree, and almost all of them are pretty well exactly 1 degree of arc across. I find that pretty fascinating. There must be a reason why they're all pretty well the same. And they're spread all over the place, and I've said they're also polarized. And the reason that's important is because if they're polarized, You have to have the existence of baryonic material for them to be polarized. Baryonic material is like a rock or some object with mass that as the photon goes by it becomes polarized and redshifted. So baryonic mass has to exist prior to the existence of the background radiation. And that's important. That's very important. And we can actually verify that. And that would mean that the background radiation is not the leftover radiation from the Big Bang. The background radiation is just the ambient temperature of the local region of space, which is 2.7 degrees, would sound about right. So that's where we're going next. So I'm just showing that we can basically take this interaction between a photon and a gravitational field and apply, this mathematics is kind of simple, just apply that to the situation. And yeah, there you go. Kind of wandered off a bit.
So we're talking about redshifts.
Yeah, galactic redshifts.
So we're talking about the galaxy now.
We're talking about all the galaxies in the universe itself. Background radiation is the universe itself. We think it's the background radiation is the temperature of local space-time, of the local region of space.
Oh, you mentioned Teddy Schmidt. Who is Teddy Schmidt?
Oh, Teddy Schmidt I worked with the Alberta Research Council with back in the late 70s on the AOSTRA project. Remember the early 80s and late 70s. And we were looking at the mathematics of injecting steam into an oil sand bed. And we did a heck of a lot of mathematics. Was done some brilliant, brilliant stuff was done with some. There are a number of scientists from Chalk River. They all knew how to build a CANDU reactor. We had Russian scientists, German scientists, Polish scientists, scientists from all over the world.
Where was Teddy from?
Teddy was from Venezuela. He's from Colombia originally, but he came up from Venezuela as a Venezuelan.
He's a mathematician?
Brilliant, brilliant mathematician. Hmm. Yeah. And yeah, a number of people there were just unbelievably brilliant. That
Must have learned a lot.
Oh, heck, I managed to play around and, mess with a whole mess of stuff. And there were people there you could bounce it off of to find out if you're going in the wrong direction or the right direction. Hmm. It's impossible to work in a vacuum. But if you're working so someone can reply to you and say, well, that is wrong because you're going in the wrong direction, that's really, really helpful. I don't understand where that goes. So, to substantiate that and say, oh, that looks like a good idea. Let's,
add some. So it sounds like you've been thinking about this for a long time.
I've been thinking about this pretty well my whole life. Yeah.
All right. So shall we get on with the next bit?
Okay. Thank you.
Did you say what you needed to say?
Chapter 9. A particle photon, a particle slash photon, gravitational interaction. 9.1, discussion. If a photon having momentum, h nu over c, bounces off a sphere at rest, having mass m, and is deflected by a small angle, theta, then the sphere would gain momentum, reference 8. This would mean that the sphere would, in an ideal situation, move very, very slowly. Since the sphere has gained kinetic energy, according to the law of conservation of energy, the photon would lose energy equivalent to the kinetic energy gained by the sphere. As a result, the photon must redshift. 9.2, elastic collision. Getting notices here. 9.2, elastic collision. Let us examine this interaction as a gravitational slingshot between a photon and the sun. A slingshot can be estimated as an elastic collision and compared to the interaction of a collision between billiard balls on a frictionless pool table. If the sun is considered an incompressible billiard ball, and the photon is considered as an incompressible cue ball, barely touching the sun in a so-called kiss shot, then we can calculate a possible change in frequency as follows. Let theta be the angle of the photon coming off the kiss compared to traveling in a straight line as if missing the hit. If the sun has mass m and recoils with velocity v, the conservation of momentum demands h nu over c equals mv sine theta over 2 plus h nu prime over c cos theta. For the x direction, and mv cos theta over 2 equals h nu prime over c sine theta for the y direction. I turn the page here. Substituting for mv from equation 2 and equation 1, we have h nu over c equals h nu prime over c cos theta minus h nu prime over c sine theta over 2 all over cos theta over 2, which reduces to nu equals nu prime, left bracket, sine theta over 2 all over cos theta over 2 plus cos theta, right bracket. For very small theta, nu equals nu prime, left bracket, theta squared over 2 plus 1, right bracket. Let nu minus nu prime equals delta nu. Then subtracting nu prime from both sides, delta nu is approximately very closely equal to nu prime theta squared over 2. Since nu prime equals nu very closely, or nu prime is very closely equal to nu, because it's going to be a very small effect, we have delta nu is equal to nu theta squared over 2. 9.3. Calculations from general relativity. The first approximation of a solution to a solar photon interaction was done by Einstein, reference 8, in which the following equation was derived. Theta in radians is equal to 4m over r, in which theta in radians is the angle coming off the interaction in radians. M is the mass of the sun in meters, or the Schwarzschild radius. The mass of the sun is about equal to 1475 meters. R is the distance from the center of the sun to the point of perihelion of the hyperbolic orbit of the photon in the path around the sun following the geodesic, also in meters. To convert R to the angular separation from the star to the sun in radians, divide R by an astronomical unit. The formula, derived previously, is delta nu equals theta squared degrees over 2 all times nu, where theta in degrees is the angle coming off the interaction in degrees, delta nu is a change in frequency, and nu is a frequency of the signal. Combine both formula to yield delta nu is equal to m squared pi squared all over 2025 times r squared, and that's all times nu. Or delta E is delta E is equal to m squared pi squared all over 2025 r squared all times E, or delta P is equal to m squared pi squared all over 2025 r squared all times P. Bypassing the sun, a photon is redshifted by a factor of about 10 to the negative 7th. It's beautiful, but it sure ain't pretty.
Thanks for listening, everybody. If you liked what you heard, you may subscribe in your podcast provider and perhaps share in various social media sites. Bruce has promised he won't change the links anymore and screw up trying to find the next episode. Please enjoy the rest of your day and may everything work out for the best. We try to have a new podcast every Saturday, so see you next week.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.